Night Train Magazine is an ambitious and high-quality new literary magazine that hopes to help good writers become great ones. They incorporate a rail stop theme in each issue, featuring an American town or business district with a distinctive railroad history. Their forthcoming issue will feature the middlemost stop on the Long Island Railroad, Kings Park, New York. Managing editor Sue Henderson is a recipient of an Academy of American Poets Award. Her writing has appeared in many literary magazines, most recently along with writers such as Jonathan Franzen, Joyce Carol Oates, and Dave Eggers in the McSweeney's book, The Future Dictionary of America. Associate editor Tom Jackson has written dozens of articles for national magazines in the fields of sports, insurance, and engineering, and he is currently co-writing the autobiography of a former Negro Leagues baseball player. I spoke with Sue and Tom about the fate and future of literary magazines. You say that your publication's purpose is to provide readers with the best possible fiction that you can find. What kind of standards does your editorial staff use to discern what that great fiction is?
My standard is pretty simple. It's entirely subjective. When I read something I think I might accept, I start to get very excited, and I'll start laughing out loud or sound like a lunatic, and I'll say, oh my God, that's brilliant. And as I near the end, where most, I guess, otherwise great stories fail, I start to worry, you know, will the end hold up to the rest? And will it surprise me, or is it going to go the way I expect? So I get this physical rush when I come across a story that thrills me from the first sentence to the last. And you should see how fast I race that story to our fiction editor, Rusty Barnes, because I'm saying, quick, you got to grab this before another magazine swoops it up and accepts it first. So that's part of the process. The other is that it's not only my taste or Rusty's taste that influences the process, because we have a print magazine that operates online, and what that allows us to do is we have our pick of editors around the world. And so our associate editors come from New York and California, Boston, rural Virginia, and Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And each of these editors holds high standards, but we've each been influenced by different writers. And so I think that's part of where the diversity of Night Train comes from. And I think in the end, what we don't want is a well-written, interesting, publishable story. What we want is a story that thrills us or breaks us or leaves us, you know, spinning and racing that story to submit it to the O. Henry Awards.
So you're not just stopping at it's well-written. You really want to be moved.
I think what I want is the panic that I'll lose sleep if I don't get that story on time, if I don't get it before another magazine does.
Of the submissions that you get, do you get more prose? Well, do you accept poetry, first of all?
We don't. We only take prose, but we're one of the very few markets who take novellas and short stories and flash fiction.
So you're straight fiction, no nonfiction?
Right, straight fiction.
That's actually a little unusual in the world of literary magazines. There's a tendency to do a variety. You get the sort of panoply of nonfiction and fiction. What was the decision behind going with only fiction?
I think this was part of the vision of the co-founders, Rusty Barnes and Rod Sino. I think they just felt like there was so much good short fiction out there that they didn't want anything else distracting from it.
Well, tell me a little bit about how a literary journal, from your perspectives, achieves respectability. I mean, what makes people, first of all, want to be printed in it, writers? What makes the literary community regard it highly?
The quality of the literature you print is the basis for respectability. That's something that all journals, whether they're print or online, aspire to. You also benefit from having established and respected authors in your journal. But the real key to any of that may simply come down to being out there consistently and reliably. Visibility is key. People won't read the books they don't know about, and of course they're not going to submit to them. We know that our editorial staff has the literary chops to see that only the best stories get into Night Train. Our editors are also successful enough in their own right. Well, Sue, for example, is one of the stable of extremely talented and creative writers appearing in the Future Dictionary of America. That's a book featuring such authors as Dave Eggers, Joyce Carol Oates, and Stephen King, and of course the Future Dictionary, in case you haven't checked out the LA Times nonfiction bestseller list, is number 14 this week. So, and anyway, we have connections with prominent writers such as those. to others such as Bob Halenga, Steve Allman, George Saunders, DeWitt Henry, Roy Keezy, and John Warner of McSweeney's, and even up-and-comers like Pia Earhart and Angie McCullough. So we know that the literary side of Night Train will kind of take care of itself thanks to the talent and obvious passion of our editorial staff. So the real hard work, and this is something that was recognized and established right away by Sue when she took over as managing editor of Night Train, is seeing that we get the book out on time. Then we have to make sure that everyone knows that we are out there and that we can get the book in their hands fairly easily. So it's that consistency, that visibility. They're what raise our profile, and that's the springboard to respectability. Now, there's one other type of respectability that we really strive to maintain, and it's something that definitely sets us apart from many other lit journals, and that's the promptness of our replies to the stories that people submit. Obviously, we're going to be rejecting the vast majority of the stories that are sent to us. So we make sure that our constructiveness with our rejections is very, very high. Our editors will often write several paragraphs to particularly talented writers whose stories are wonderful, but they're simply not quite up to the standard we're looking for. They'll also suggest ways of possibly improving the stories and even recommend other markets that those writers might send their work to that might be more receptive, might be more likely to print their work. So this, I think, is what makes Night Train the kind of journal that writers want to submit to, that they'll want to buy, read, and keep in their bookcases.
What do you think the place of the literary journal / magazine is in literary culture? What roles can it play, and how can it serve writers, literacy, literature, the encouragement of reading? This is a broad question, I know, but there are still people who are not quite sure what literary journals are all about.
Well, I know that, for example, one of Night Train's main goals is to provide these talented new writers, the ones with perspectives a little off the beaten path, the ones that make us passionate, that make us want to lose sleep if we don't get them in our book. We try to get them a literary foothold in the literary world. Journals like ours, as Sue said, they remain the only outlets for short story writers. And, of course, that's why Rod and Rusty founded Night Train as a short fiction-only journal. You know, there's this tremendous pool of short fiction writers out there, and the publishing world just doesn't recognize that medium, really, for new writers. So journals like Night Train become the proving ground for these talented writers. So we'll put their stories in a book with some more established writers that gives them instant credibility. And then by introducing these unique voices to the literary world, I'd say we're doing a pretty great service. We are providing meaning to the literary journal medium, and we're hoping that it will help these writers gain the attention of agents and publishers and make their writing more prevalent throughout the literary world.
To answer that further, part of what literary journals do is it's exposure to a variety of writers. And I think exposure is the main thing that literary journals serve for the writers. But the other thing is the publishing houses sometimes have a very narrow view of what will sell. And a lot of times what will sell isn't what people want to produce, where their hearts are. And so I think what the literary journals serve right now is a place for more experimental work, work that might stand the test of time better than the commercial work that's selling today, but stuff that, for whatever reason, the publishing houses just won't take the chance on right now.
In other words, the literary journal also offers something to not just the writer, of course, but to readers who perhaps don't have time to read books as much as they'd like or are looking for a variety of new voices and don't want to have to read seven books to find seven new voices. So it also is offering a service to readers who are living in this busy modern day.
I think it does, although I think a lot of people, sadly, don't have time for the literary journals either. I do think that the literary journals expose you to a wide range of artists. So maybe you pick up a journal because you know one author, but then in reading through it, you find another. And if you're like me, you then go Google that person and find out what else they've written. And then there you go. Someone who was unknown to you becomes known.
How have you gone about attracting the attention of well-known writers, like you mentioned Steve Almond and George Saunders? Are they fairly open and game when you approach them, or have you had to do some pitching in some respect?
We solicit to raise the bar of what we're looking for, and I read almost every magazine and webzine I can get my hands on, and I also scour workshops. And if I come across a story I like, I'll usually write to that author and ask for it, you know, because I'm greedy for good stories. I go to readings, and if somebody just knocks me out, I'll go talk to them after the reading and ask if they'll submit something. So that's how we find some of the better-known writers. But honestly, sometimes those better-known writers then have to send me 5 or 6 stories before I find the one that thrills me. And so in the end, I guess we're seeing more and more well-known writers in our slush pile who come to us without any solicitation. But I have to say that what excites me is that it still comes down to you have to fall in love with the story. And if I have a well-known writer in the slush pile, and if I have an unknown, and that unknown knocks me out, that's who we're going to publish.
Tell me a little bit about your, what I think is a very unique program, your Rail Stop sponsorship program.
Well, as you know, we're a not-for-profit organization. We're a book with a completely volunteer staff. Night Train's first 2 issues were published thanks to the donations of various sizes and from friends and families of our co-founders, Rod and Rusty, but let's face it, that's a well that kind of runs dry in a big hurry. So when Sue came on board as managing editor, she asked me to join as well, primarily to assist in the raising of funds in a more efficient manner. So after a couple of months of what could charitably be called modest success, Sue and her husband and I brainstormed a bit on other ways to raise funds, and thus the Rail Stop program came about. Obviously, it plays on our book's name, and the idea is that we feature towns or business districts from anywhere in the country with a unique rail history. So in each issue, we feature an individual town or that business district, include their name on the cover right by the Night Train flag, and then we also include a photo-illustrated article on the back about that sponsor's history. We'll also include a directory of all the businesses and contributors. Anyone who gave money on behalf of that rail stop, we'll put that in that directory. And then we'll also schedule a reading in the sponsoring town, mention that that town's name prominently in our press releases and any of our promotional efforts. And then we provide the town plenty of copies of the issue in which it's featured. So in return for all of this, the rail stop sponsor provides us with the funds to print, distribute, and promote that issue. The actual dollar figure has kind of varied. It's gone kind of up and down from 3 to 4 to 5, but you know, the raise and the way that the costs have gone up a little bit, that's attributed to our journal's growth. But see, an interesting residual of our program that we found that in dealing with our contacts with the Rail Stop sponsoring towns so far is that we found that having a few hundred copies of our book available in these towns has meant that our journal has made it into the hands of folks who would otherwise not be reading literary fiction. So in a very real way, they've been making progress in reversing the trend reported by a certain NEA report that literary reading is in decline. Right now, we're considering various locations for our 5th issue, Rail Stop. That's going to be next spring's issue. We're looking at Indiana, a place in Colorado, one in Minnesota, and of course California. Frankly, we'd like to get a West Coast location since we've already had rail stops in the Midwest and in the East Coast. Those have been Seminary Street in Galesburg, Illinois, and Kings Park in New York and Long Island. So just wanted to tell your listeners that any community that is interested in being a Night Train rail stop can call me at 309-530-5375 or email me at tjackson@nighttrainmagazine.com, and I'd love to talk to them.
Do you have any other creative plans? I would say your Rail Stop program is pretty darn creative, and also unusual and probably inclined to work because it's so unusual and so specific. When you get communities involved, it's, you know, you're guaranteed to get some support. But do you have any other creative plans, considering the amount of literary magazines out there in the market? And albeit there are tiers of some better than others, but there are enough quality magazines out there to keep Night Train standing apart, to keep it making a place for itself.
I think the efforts we're making right now are still pretty fresh and seem to be effective. So I think we're just going to stay the course and just see how effective the Rail Stop program is. It'll probably take two or three issues, really, to gauge its effectiveness anyway. And by simply doing what we do on a day-to-day basis, just from a strict literary standpoint, we're setting ourselves apart from a lot of literary journals, as far as I'm concerned. But ultimately, yeah, we do have to keep moving ahead from a literary perspective. I think it was Rusty who said that once we get to the point where you can read a story and say, yeah, that's a typical Night Train story, it's time to change our perspective a bit. You know, we want to keep finding new things that will take our readers a bit by surprise. And I think Sue had actually described that situation all the more eloquently already.
As you said, this is a volunteer staff. This is a time-consuming effort. I know both of you must have some dedication to literature, to writing, to perhaps, I know that you are both writers in some fashion yourselves. What is it that you would say keeps you doing this work, makes you enjoy it, pursue it, and be dedicated to it?
This will sound crazy, but I love the slush pile. I love being won over by an author I never heard of. I love the heart and the vulnerability and the hope that writers show, the courage it takes for a writer to show someone else what they've written. And so it's really a privilege to have someone place something so intimate in my hands, you know, to see the world through someone else's eyes. I really do love that, and I love finding the best that's out there. My husband's uncle, Joseph Campbell, was a real believer in following your bliss, which is a way of saying you find and pursue the thing that you're truly passionate about. And so I feel like I'm doing, with both my writing and my editing, you know, I'm following my bliss. And it's such a privilege because I know not everyone's lucky enough to have their career and their passion so intertwined. So for me, it's, you know, it's a labor of love.
It truly is a labor of love. It is a joy to be able to read the stories that these people send. To have access to other writers, to attend the conferences with other editors of literary journals, and just to exchange ideas, to be enlightened to new writers, to always have the access to the stories that you know is going to be brand new, that's going to be a very big surprise, that will really grab you. Plus, it gives me the opportunity to work with people who I really care about. Some of the editors on the staff are very, very dear friends of mine. Sue is my favorite writer, for example, and it's just, you know, a joy working with these people, and the subject matter is wonderful. I do have a real job. I'm basically an advertising copywriter in a company in central Illinois, so working on Night Train is a wonderful departure. Writing is still at the core of all of it, so it just keeps me going.
Well, the final question I want to ask also to both of you is another broad question, and I'm asking it not just specifically to Night Train, but of course that's where you're welcome to speak from, but also from the point of view of what literary journals can offer. And the question really is what kind of contribution do literary journals make to the culture, really, at large? And you mentioned the NEA report, Reading at Risk, is what you were referring to, which cited all these horrible declines and how that reflects back on, essentially, civic life, the arts, culture. What would you say, you know, if you could sort of proudly sum up what you think it is that a journal like Night Train provides the culture with?
Running a literary magazine and striving to be a writer, for that matter, is probably not a logical choice. Obviously, as we've said, we do it because it's our passion. And while that NEA report stated that readership may be down, there is an increase in writers, which I believe means the inclination toward literature is there, and it just has to be tapped. And because so many of these writers who they are working in the short fiction genre, this is what they have time to do. This is how they're getting their experience in doing so. They are going to need an outlet for this, something that can be, they can publish their work in, that we can give to those who want to read. And so I think we fill that need. I do believe that America is filled with a lot of bright people who simply haven't taken the time to pick up good, intelligently written fiction. And as we indicated already, the Rail Stop program is changing that, at least, you know, town by town. We are getting more and more people to be reading literary fiction. So we're obviously helping to change that. I know that it's what Rod and Rusty found a night train on. It's obviously what Sue and I are passionate about and dedicated to. And it's a pursuit that I know that we and, gosh, hundreds of others that we've come across in, at conferences and through the stories that we've read are looking forward to continuing for the rest of our lives.
The main thing I see is it's an outlet for more experimental work, the work that writers truly want to be writing rather than writers trying to write what the market will sell, and again, exposure. But I think it's interesting. I think your question, it's a logical question and it's an illogical field. And I kind of feel like, you know, if you ask a mother why she has a baby, even though her finances aren't in order and she's not totally convinced the man she married is in it for the long haul, and you find out that they didn't have the baby for any logical reasons, and despite all the troubles that babies can bring in their life and how expensive they are and whatever, you know, the mother doesn't regret it. And I feel like this business is the same for me. There's nothing logical about it, and I can't stop myself. I love it.
Sue Henderson and Tom Jackson of Night Train Magazine. You're listening to Word by Word. I'm your host, Jordan Rosenfeld.
Nebraska ain't nowhere to be in the middle of June 1893. Got my honey, got a sandwich, rolling along. This whole lot of women start singing her song. Clickety, 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 clack. This ain't a Wyoming trail, it's a track. This ain't a wagon covered parade. I hope, Silver, you're riding a train. If you sung with country, be about prisons, pickups, and pain. You said no country, it's another folk song. Just another folk song. Everybody got a folk song about a train.
Now, a short story titled Bar Mitzvah by Nancy Ludmerer, featured in Night Train magazine.
When Benji started to choke on a piece of celery stuffed with scallion cream cheese, I turned from the buffet table and asked, "Are you okay?" And when he shook his head, I said, "Raise your arms." But he kept choking, so I slapped him on the back of his fancy new suit, and then two words clicked in my head, Heimlich maneuver. So I punched my fist into his stomach, even though this was the wrong way to do it. But I couldn't think of the right way. His gray eyes, huge and terrified. I had never seen him that scared, so I cried, "We need help over here. Benjamin is choking." And then she was there, Dinah, wicked stepmother in her fuchsia gown, airline stewardess. Oh, no, flight attendant. Benji had corrected me once, "Don't be a sexist, Ma." And she clasped her arms around him from behind and jerked back hard, and the celery flew across the room on angel's wings. And I said, "Thank you, God," while this woman, who had wrecked our lives 10 years earlier, hugged my son. And I knew then, on his bar mitzvah day, that for everything there is a purpose under heaven.
A short story titled Bar Mitzvah by Nancy Ludmerer, featured in Night Train magazine.